A note for regular listeners of the Memory Palace podcast, I am currently the artist in residence at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and this piece is episode number one of that project. It's called Recent Acquisition. You're going to listen to this one in Gallery 760 in the American Wing. It's the one with Washington crossing the Delaware. Just ask anyone and they'll help you find it. I guarantee you won't be the first person to ask them where to find Washington crossing the Delaware that day. You can wander around while you're listening. You can sit in a bench. Whatever works for you. This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. They weren't going anywhere, the people living here in the East. They were tied to the land, to an American ideal still so new there in the middle of the 19th century. They were citizen farmers tilling the Shenandoah Valley, fourth-generation Yankees, now first- and second-generation Americans, stacking their stone walls and claiming the corners of the land. They were new immigrants, former Europeans, who had traveled as far as the Cuyahoga River Valley or the Delmarva Peninsula, and were done traveling. The East was settled, and the Easterners were settling. But there was a continent out beyond their well-stacked walls, and they knew it. Even as they tilled and tended, as they laid cobblestones in new streets and new cities, bent hoops for barrels that would carry goods out to a wider world, that few of them were ever going to see, now that they'd settled for smaller lives. Other men were sent to see that world, and chart it and claim it for the government, and tame it for the mining concerns, and land speculators and the like. So westward went expeditions of necessary men. Surveyors and cartographers, geologists, trackers, engineers, riflemen, and artists. Necessary because the settled people in the settled East wanted to see too. And so when westward went Ferdinand Hayden to map the Rockies and Yellowstone, and John Wesley Powell to brave the Colorado, the painter Thomas Moran went with them. And when Frederick Lander laid out a route for the Pacific Railroad, Albert Bierstadt was there to paint what he saw. You can see some of what he painted here in this gallery, on the southern wall. If you want to find it, find George Washington. Him you can't miss. If George took a moment out of crossing the Delaware to see where that whole business was going to lead one day, he'd just need to look to his left and find Bierstadt's masterpiece near the center of the wall. A Shoshone band, living in a dappled glen at the foot of the Rockies. Living in paradise, basically. Bierstadt painted it when he got back to his studio on 10th Street downtown, and declared with all of his bearded, puff-chested, 19th-century white dude bravado that one day soon, the Edenic idol, enjoyed by the Shoshone people shown there in the foreground of his painting, would be replaced by a city populated by our descendants. Our meaning people like Bierstadt. People other than those already in the picture. A city would rise on that spot, which would house an art museum worthy of that very painting. One day soon. When the West was settled. There is no real view of the Rockies quite as spectacular as the one in Bierstadt's painting. They don't actually look like that. Pictures like this one didn't merely show. The ones that captured the Eastern imagination, the ones that wound up in this museum, in this most settled of places, some 150 years later, embellished the American landscape. The plains are more fruited. The purple mountains' majesty are more majestic and more purple. The light, the future, everything is brighter. And those pictures, when shown back east after the Civil War, helped unsettle the settled, helped urge pioneers and homesteaders to leave home. And for those who stayed, for those who would never see the land beyond their well-stacked walls with their own eyes, they had Jules Tavernier. Jules Tavernier was trained as a painter and an illustrator back home in Paris. He fought in and then fled the Franco-Prussian War and found himself here in New York in 1870. He took a gig with Harper's Magazine, which sent him out to see the changing continent, so folks could see what was happening out there from the comfort of their homes. There was another artist with him too, a fellow Frenchman. But I'm leaving him out of the story. If Bierstadt could bend mountains to his will, then I ought to at least be able to ditch a character or two. Find Tavernier in this room. Picture him in any of its landscapes. a wiry man in his 30s, sunburned despite a wide-brimmed hat. Place him in any of these American scenes. His easel slung over his shoulder as he walks down a rutted path beside a tributary of the Ohio or the Susquehanna. Why not find him sitting on a stump in Bierstadt's Ersatz Glen? For 2 years, 1873 and 1874, Tavernier traveled west for Harper's, drew men stoking fires to melt iron in Pittsburgh and to refine sugar in Texas, drew a railroad town in Kansas, deserted save for the wolves, rode with families as they huddled in wagons wrapped in blankets against prairie winds. He watched men skin buffalo by the score, so easy to hunt right then, so hard to find just a few years later. Set up his easel in the land of the Sioux, just before the United States declared war and took that land. Painted row upon row of the houses that were starting to radiate out from the center of town at the edge of the Rockies, Denver, Colorado, on its way to becoming the kind of city Bierstadt could hardly have dreamed up, with museums and skyscrapers and stadiums and Quiznos and auto zones, and no Shoshone band living off the land. The people back in the settled East saw the settling of the West through Tavernier's eyes. He himself would settle in Monterey, California. He'd eventually die in Hawaii while seeking a further frontier. But that's a whole other story. This story will end in Northern California, where Tavernier found communities of people ready to live comfortable lives at the edge of America. He found parks and places to get a decent steak. And he found patrons excited to employ the Frenchman made famous by his work for Harper's Magazine. Commissions poured in, and they didn't want him to do what had made his name. Didn't want him to turn his trained eye on current-day California. Instead, Tavernier was paid over and over again to paint the past. The recent past, a few years back, when his patrons had braved the journey west. And so he specialized for a time in a genre all his own, in which a wagon train approaches from the east, across Wyoming, say, or through the Black Hills of the Dakota Territory, while in the foreground, Indian marauders lie in ambush. People wanted something hanging over their fireplace to immortalize just how much they'd risk to sit by that fireplace, and to commemorate a time just past. It all changed so fast then. Before the so-called savages had been subdued in the lands between the settled east and the settled west. And that's how Tavernier made a lot of his living. But there's one painting, his masterpiece, surely, painted right around that time. And it doesn't just show the present. Doesn't just show the way they lived then, when the West, as they say, was won. It shows how it was won, and when it was won, and by whom. And it shows what was lost. Find it to the left of the Bierstadt. George Washington could see it if he just craned his neck, though part of me thinks maybe he should avert his eyes. Tavernier's biggest patron was a man with an almost literary name, Tiburcio Parrot. The Parrots were big in mining and mineral rights and land deals and the like, and they owned mercury mines near Clear Lake, California, up around Mendocino. It's a beautiful country. The country of the Pomo people for centuries. But by the middle of the 19th century, there were a few Pomo left around there. Blame the Spanish, blame disease, blame mercury mines, and families with unlikely names. But there was a band there at the edge of the water at the foot of the mountains, Bierstadt style, and Parrot knew them well. His family owned the mountains all around them, after all. And he wanted to own that last stretch of land there, too. And one day he was visited by the Baron de Rothschild, a family name so famous for its wealth, for its centrality to power, as well as its vile invocation in various anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. That literature could hardly do it justice. Parrot wanted to forge a bond, establish a professional relationship with this particular Rothschild. And so he showed him a good time, in lieu of floor seats at a Warriors game or a table at Chez Panisse. The San Franciscan talked his way into a sacred Pomo ceremony in a longhouse by the lake. You can see them in there, two rows behind the women lit by the skylight to the left of the pole at the center of the longhouse, in bow ties and three-piece suits. Parrot paid his friend Tavernier to paint the scene as a souvenir, a gift for the Baron de Rothschild of this moment they'd shared. Before the deal was done that would secure the land, and mean that there would be no more scenes like this one captured here by Tavernier. No more dances in the subterranean longhouse at Clear Lake, California, as it's called in the plastic plaque at the museum here in the settled east. And no more band living by the edge of the water at the foot of the mountains. This episode is written and produced and stuff by me, Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace Podcast, and executive produced by Lamour Tomer, general manager of concerts and lectures at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Research assistance from Andrew Milne. My residency is made possible by the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Chester Dale Fund. The Memory Palace is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, which receives support from the Knight Foundation, MailChimp, AdZerk, and from its generous listeners. Learn more about the Memory Palace at thememorypalace.org and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts.